Chapter 28, The Silver Bullet. From the Los Angeles airport, you get to the Stinger factory by heading east on the Santa Monica Freeway. It's about an hour's ride east toward the mountains before you're into the other Southern California, a small-town world of Taco Bells, car washes, and Sizzlers. And then, just beyond the Humane Society shelter in Rancho Cucamonga, the General Dynamics plant suddenly springs out of nowhere. Building 600 is about as anonymous a structure as can be found anywhere in America. But in the fall of 1985, the ladies of Rancho Cucamonga were busy inside it, assembling the silver bullet that would soon wreak havoc on the Red Army in Afghanistan. Had any of the holy warriors seen this facility in 1985, they would have been deeply confused, for Building 600 is truly an infidel's factory. To begin with, almost all of the workers were women, and California women at that. Most were in their 20s or 30s, many were blonde, and more than a few favored tight jeans. They tended to be young mothers from two-income families or single mothers raising kids of their own. Their work, connecting miniature wires, looking through microscopes and large magnifiers to solder circuits, required a careful hand and patience. Starting pay was $4.80 an hour and went as high as $11 for those with seniority. The ladies normally pulled 8-hour shifts, but in 1985, the Stinger was considered so vital to the defense of the United States that work in Building 600 continued around the clock. Some areas of the plant were sealed off and temperature controlled. It was like a hospital operating room, the women and few men dressed in white gowns and plastic caps. They worked with tiny gyroscopes and miniature motors. Some of the coils they handled had only 1/5000th of an inch clearance between parts. The whole exercise was exceedingly delicate, but miraculously what emerged at the end was a 35-pound dark green tube that could be dropped on the ground, frozen, thrown in a lake, or kept around for 10 years. Even after all that abuse, the electrical engineers and rocket scientists from Building 600 insisted their Stingers would be ready for action. They were designed for American soldiers to use, but as it turns out, they were sufficiently user-friendly to make it possible for a simple man with no technical knowledge to put the dull tube on his shoulder, get a MiG or helicopter in his sights, pull the trigger, and bring down a $20 million jet fighter or gunship. The U.S. Army thought so highly of the Stinger in those Cold War years that it stockpiled them in Europe as fast as the ladies of Building 600 could make them. The Joint Chiefs, citing the need for as many as possible to prepare for an all-out war with the Red Army in Europe, claimed that none could be spared for a CIA sideshow, and they asked Deputy Director John McMahon to block any efforts to deploy them in Afghanistan. On the wall of the warehouse where these 35-pound shoulder-launched anti-aircraft missiles were warehoused was the motto, "If it flies, it dies." But for the Afghans in the fall of 1985, the Stinger was still not an option the U.S. government was prepared to consider. For Charlie Wilson, the quest for something to shoot down the Hind gunship had become a total obsession. When the CIA director, Bill Casey, told Wilson that there was no silver bullet to deal with the Hind, he was alluding to the ancient belief that certain enemies of mankind surface now and then with such power and evil that they are virtually invincible and can be stopped only by a magical weapon, a silver bullet. The Lone Ranger, the hero in the cowboy stories that Wilson and Avrakatos listened to on the radio as boys, always carried with him such magic bullets to guide into the hearts of the evil ones he was pitted against. For all practical purposes, the Mi-24 Hind flying gunship was the superweapon of the Afghan War. In 1985, it remained the Soviets' one invincible, blood-curdling instrument that threatened to finally rob the Mujahideen of hope. Perhaps never had any soldiers enjoyed such total superior force as the men who flew the gunships against the Afghans. Descending out of the clouds, they would hover just out of range of the Mujahideen's machine guns. The pilots would look down on tribesmen as if they were ants. Their only question was which to shoot first and with what weapon. After firing a burst from a Gatling gun at 1,000 rounds per minute, or laying down napalm bombs, or launching one of their 128 rockets, they knew it was just a short flight back to their comfortable barracks at Bagram, where vodka and a hearty meal awaited them. For these dark gods of the sky, flying the gunships was a routine mission of death, so far removed from the ground that they would never hear the sounds of men screaming or feel the sweat and terror and agony they were inflicting. To be caught by a Hind was the nightmare of the Afghan freedom fighters, and it was literally Charlie Wilson's nightmare as well. The gunships were still flying into his dreams, the same leering Slav mowing down the helpless fighters. From the moment Wilson had sat by the bedside of a Mujahid who had been mauled and tortured by this beast, he had become determined to find a silver bullet to bring it down. But the Texan was not looking for supernatural intervention. He was an old gunnery officer with an almost religious faith in America's ability to come up with technological fixes that verged on magic. The issue was deciding to do it. It had taken the United States only 4 years to build the A-bomb once Hitler and Tojo looked as if they might win. Kennedy had been able to put a man on the moon in a decade when the Soviets seemed to be pulling ahead. So why, Wilson kept asking, couldn't the mighty United States figure out how to shoot down a helicopter? The Stinger was no secret to Charlie or Gust. They knew it was the best mule portable plane killer in the world. But in the fall of 1985, the CIA was adamant about not introducing an American weapon. Putting in the Stinger would have been like advertising the CIA's involvement in the war in Red Square. What possible reason did the agency have to be running this war if not to maintain cover for U.S. involvement? And if the agency were to hand out these instruments to the fundamentalist holy warriors, who would control them? The idea of a Khomeini loyalist shooting down a TWA flight with a General Dynamics Stinger was too much. For Charlie Wilson, denied the weapon, the restless quest continued. He was relentless and single-minded in his conviction that there had to be a weapon to challenge the Hind. If not the Swiss Oerlikon, then the Israeli Charlie Horse. If not the Charlie Horse, then perhaps the Swedish RBS-70, which he had forced the upgraders to buy and try out. If not the Swedish weapon, then perhaps his plan to place a phosphorus charge in the 12.7mm machine gun ammunition. Once lodged in the Hind's armor, he argued, the bullets would act as incendiary devices. He became fixated on this, and by that fall, Muhammad's Egyptians, as well as the Communist Chinese and the Tinkerers, were all trying to develop this version of the silver bullet. Even Gust Avrakatos, who had long since abandoned the idea of finding a single weapon to deal with the Hind, was so infected with Wilson's mania that one day he too went over the edge. A twisted old agency veteran named Sam, whose son had died in the Vietnam War, told him he could build a Stinger from scratch using cannibalized parts. What Sam described was an amalgam of all the anti-aircraft missiles then in operation, the SA-7's great motor, the beautiful fins from the blowpipe, the wonderful aerodynamic casings from the Red Eye, and the Stinger's great warhead. The only problem, acknowledged Sam, was with the patents. "Fuck the patents, this is a covert war," Gust told him. "Let them sue us." Mike Vickers, meanwhile, was coolly insisting that they already were assembling the equivalent of the silver bullet. No one weapon, not even the Stinger, could do it all, he argued. The secret was in the mix, in the combination of weapons that were just then being introduced into the field. As usual, he was taking the long view, explaining how their efforts were just beginning to come together and how it would be another 6 months or more before the weapons and training could all be introduced and begin paying off. It was not an easy argument to make at that point, because the Mujahideen seemed to be in big trouble. That fall, General Varenikov, in a bid to break the resistance, sent 20,000 troops up to the Pakistan border to overrun the Mujahideen stronghold at Khost. A Time magazine article reporting the loss quoted a dramatic message from the Afghan commander, Jalaluddin Haqqani. "We have been without sleep for 48 hours. It is the biggest battle of the war. We have lost many men, but we will not lose the war." To many, it looked like a full-scale disaster, but Vickers told Gust that Khost was nothing to be alarmed about. It was like all the big battles in Vietnam. What good had it done the army to win the Battle of Hamburger Hill? After tremendous casualties, the U.S. soldiers had discovered that they were king of a desolate hillside in the middle of nowhere. They had won a great victory, but then they simply left Hamburger Hill, and the Viet Cong moved back in. Vickers was now seeing in Afghanistan the mirror image of what had happened to the United States in Vietnam. The Soviets were supposed to be providing support to the independent Afghan government. It was, in fact, their puppet government. The Red Army was supposedly just serving as advisors and suppliers of the Afghan army, which had been close to 100,000 strong at the beginning of the war. Now, after the tremendous infusion of Soviet arms and money, it was down to 30,000, and units were defecting en masse to the Mujahideen. Once the Soviets had determined that the Afghans wouldn't fight, They'd found themselves with no choice but to take over the fighting. It had been the same for the United States, and just as in Vietnam, the Soviet infantry hadn't been organized to cope with a dedicated, cunning, and increasingly well-armed guerrilla force. To compensate, the Soviets, like the Americans before them, had grown increasingly dependent on air power.